imagined would be Jace, though she was nice enough not to say it. But I thought it would be a good idea to have him in the band, honestly. If Eric and the rest of them can't tell him you're a vampire, they can't tell everyone else either. Hopefully, it'll put an end to that stupid idea. They were nearly at Luke's house. Simon could see it across the street, the windows lit up yellow against the coming dark. Clary paused at a gap in the fence. Remember when we killed a bunch of Rom demons here? You and Jace killed some Rom demons. I almost threw up. Simon remembered, but his mind wasn't on it. He was thinking of Camille, sitting across from him in the courtyard, saying,
"You befriend Shadowhunters, but you can never be out there. You will always be other and outside."
He looked sideways at Clary, wondering what she would say if he told her about his meeting with the vampire and her offer. He imagined that she would probably be terrified. The fact that he couldn't be harmed hadn't yet stopped her from worrying about his safety.
"You wouldn't be scared now," she said softly, as if reading his mind. "Now you have the mark."
She turned to look at him, still leaning against the fence.
"Does anyone ever notice or ask you about it?"
He shook his head.
"My hair covers it mostly, and anyway, it's faded a lot. See?" He pushed his hair aside.
Clary reached out and touched his forehead and the curving scripted mark there. Her eyes were sad, as they had been that day in the Hall of Accords in Alicante, where she'd cut the oldest curse of the world into his skin.
"Does it hurt?"
"No. No, it doesn't."
"And Cain said unto the Lord, 'My punishment is greater than I can bear,'" he thought.
"You know I don't blame you, don't you? You saved my life."
"I know."
Her eyes were shining. She dropped her hand from his forehead and scrubbed the back of her glove across her face.
"Damn, I hate crying."
"Well, you better get used to it," he said.
When her eyes widened, he added hastily,
"I meant the wedding. It's what, next Saturday? Everyone cries at weddings."
She snorted.
"How are your mom and Luke, anyway?"
"Disgustingly in love. It's horrible. Anyway," she patted him on the shoulder, "I should go in. See you tomorrow,"
he nodded.
"Sure, tomorrow."
He watched her as she ran across the street and up the stairs to Luke's front door.
Tomorrow.
He wondered how long it had been since he had gone more than a few days without seeing Clary. He wondered about being a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, like Camille had said, like Raphael had said.
"Their brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground."
He wasn't Cain, who had killed his brother, but the curse believed he was. It was strange, he thought, waiting to lose everything, not knowing if it would happen or not. The door shut behind Clary. Simon turned to head down Kent, toward the G train stop at Lorimer Street. It was nearly full dark now, the sky overhead a swirl of gray and black. Simon heard tires squeal on the road behind him, but he didn't turn around. Cars drove too fast on this street all the time, despite the cracks and potholes. It wasn't until the blue van drew up beside him and screeched to a stop that he turned to look. The van's driver yanked the keys from the ignition, killing the engine, and threw open the door. It was a man, a tall man, dressed in a gray hooded tracksuit and sneakers. The hood pulled down so low that it hid most of his face. He leaped down from the driver's seat, and Simon saw that there was a long, shimmering knife in his hand. Later, Simon would think that he should have run. He was a vampire, faster than any human. He could outrun anyone. He should have run, but he was too startled. He stood still as the man, gleaming knife in hand, came toward him. The man said something in a low, guttural voice, something in a language Simon didn't understand. Simon took a step back. "Look," he said, reaching for his pocket,
"you can have my wallet."
The man lunged at Simon, plunging the knife towards his chest. Simon stared down in disbelief. Everything seemed to be happening very slowly, as if time was stretching out. He saw the point of the knife near his chest, the tip denting the leather of his jacket, and then it sheared to the side, as if someone had grabbed the attacker's arm and yanked. The man screamed as he was jerked up into the air like a puppet being hauled up by its strings. Simon looked around wildly. Surely someone must have heard or noticed the commotion, but no one appeared. The man kept screaming, jerking wildly, while his shirt tore open down the front as if ripped apart by an invisible hand. Simon stared in horror. Huge wounds were appearing on the man's torso. His head flew back and blood sprayed from his mouth. He stopped screaming abruptly and fell, as if the invisible hand had opened, releasing him. He hit the ground and broke apart like glass shattering into 1,000 shining pieces that scattered themselves across the pavement. Simon dropped to his knees. The knife that had been meant to kill him lay a little way away, within arm's reach. It was all that was left of his attacker, save a pile of shimmering crystals that were already beginning to blow away in the brisk wind. He touched one cautiously. It was salt. He looked down at his hands. They were shaking. He knew what had happened, and why. And the Lord said unto him, Therefore, whosoever slayeth Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. So this was what sevenfold looked like. He barely made it to the gutter before he doubled over and vomited blood into the street. The moment Simon opened the door, he knew he'd miscalculated. He thought his mother would be asleep by now, but she wasn't. She was awake, sitting in an armchair facing the front door, her phone on the table next to her, and she saw the blood on his jacket immediately. To his surprise, she didn't scream, but her hand flew to her mouth.
Simon, it's not my blood, he said quickly. I was over at Eric's and Matt had a nosebleed. I don't want to hear it.
That sharp tone was one she rarely used. It reminded him of the way she talked during those last months when his father had been sick. Anxiety like a knife in her voice.
I don't want to hear any more lies.
Simon dropped his keys onto the table next to the door.
Mom, all you do is tell me lies. I'm tired of it.
That's not true,
he said, but he felt sick, knowing it was.
I just have a lot going on in my life right now.
I know you do.
His mother got to her feet. She had always been a skinny woman, and she looked bony now. Her dark hair, the same color as his, streaked with more gray than he had remembered where it fell around her face.
Come with me, young man, now.
Puzzled, Simon followed her into the small, bright yellow kitchen. His mother stopped and pointed towards the counter.
Care to explain those?
Simon's mouth went dry. Lined up along the counter like a row of toy soldiers were the bottles of blood that had been in the mini-fridge inside his closet.
One was half full,
the others entirely full. The red liquid inside them shining like an accusation. She had also found the empty blood bags he had washed out and carefully stuffed inside a shopping bag before dumping them into the trash can. They were spread out over the counter, too, like a grotesque decoration.
I thought at first the bottles were wine, Elaine Lewis said in a shaking voice. Then I found the bags, so I opened one of the bottles. It's blood, isn't it?
Simon said nothing. His voice seemed to have fled.
You've been acting so strangely lately, his mother went on.
Out all hours, you never eat, you barely sleep, you have friends I've never met, never heard of.
You think I can't tell when you're lying to me? I can tell, Simon. I thought maybe you were on drugs.
Simon found his voice.
So you searched my room?
His mother flushed.
I had to. I thought if I found drugs there, I could help you, get you into a rehab program, but this?
She gestured wildly at the bottles.
I don't even know what to think about this. What's going on, Simon? If you join some kind of cult?
Simon shook his head.
Then tell me,
his mother said, her lips trembling.
Because the only explanation I can think of are horrible and sick. Simon, please.
I'm a vampire, Simon said. He had no idea how he had said it or even why. But there it was. The words hung in the air between them like poisonous gas. His mother's knees seemed to give out, and she sank into a kitchen chair.
What did you say?
She breathed. I'm a vampire, Simon said. I've been one for about 2 months now. I'm sorry I didn't tell you before. I didn't know how. Elaine Lewis's face was chalk white.
Vampires don't exist, Simon.
Yes, he said. They do. Look, I didn't ask to be a vampire. I was attacked. I didn't have a choice. I'd change it if I could. He thought wildly back to the pamphlet Clary had given him so long ago. The one about coming out to your parents. It seemed like a funny analogy then. Now it didn't.
You think you're a vampire?
Simon's mother said numbly.
You think you drink blood?
I do drink blood, Simon said. I drink animal blood.
But you're a vegetarian.
His mother looked to be on the verge of tears.
I was. I'm not now. I can't be.
Blood is what I live on, Simon's throat felt tight. I've never hurt a person. I'd never drink someone's blood. I'm still the same person. I'm still me. His mother seemed to be fighting for control.
Your new friends, are they vampires too?
Simon thought of Isabel, Maya, Jace. He couldn't explain shadow hunters and werewolves too. It was too much.
No, but they know I am one. Did they give you drugs? Make you take something that would make you hallucinate?
She seemed to have barely heard his answer.
No, Mom. This is real. It's not real, she whispered. You think it's real. Oh, God, Simon, I'm so sorry. I should have noticed. We'll get you help. We'll find someone, a doctor, whatever it costs.
I can't go to a doctor, Mom.
Yes, you can. You need to be somewhere, a hospital, maybe.
He held out his wrist to her. Feel my pulse, he said. She looked at him bewildered.
What?
My pulse, he said.
Take it. If I have one, okay, I'll go to the hospital with you. If not, you have to believe me.
She wiped the tears from her eyes and slowly reached to take his wrist. After so long taking care of Simon's father when he'd been sick, she knew how to take a pulse as well as any nurse. She pressed her index finger to the inside of his wrist and waited. He watched as her face changed, from misery and upset to confusion and then to terror. She stood up, dropping his hand, backing away from him. Her eyes were huge and dark in her white face.
What are you?
Simon felt sick.
I told you. I'm a vampire. You're not my son. You're not Simon, she was shuddering. What kind of living thing doesn't have a pulse? What kind of monster are you? What have you done with my child?
I am Simon. He took a step towards his mother. She screamed. He had never heard a scream like that. He never wanted to again. It was a horrible noise.
Get away from me, her voice broke. Don't come any closer,
she began to whisper.
Baruch atah Adonai, shumei at tefillah.
She was praying. Simon realized with a jolt. She was so terrified of him that she was praying that he would go away, be banished. And what was worse, that he could feel it. The name of God tightened his stomach and made his throat ache. She was right to pray, he thought, sick to his soul. He was cursed. He didn't belong in the world. What kind of living thing doesn't have a pulse?
Mom,
he whispered. Mom, stop. She looked at him, wide-eyed, her lips still moving.
Mom, you don't need to be so upset.
He heard his own voice as if from a distance, soft and soothing, a stranger's voice. He kept his eyes fixed on his mother as he spoke, capturing her gaze with his as a cat might capture a mouse.
Nothing happened. You fell asleep in the armchair in the living room. You're having a bad dream that I came home and told you I was a vampire. But that's crazy. That would never happen.
She had stopped praying. She blinked.
I'm dreaming?
She repeated.
It's a bad dream, Simon said.
He moved toward her and put his hand on her shoulder. She didn't pull away. Her head was drooping like a tired child's.
Just a dream. You never found anything in my room. Nothing happened. You've just been sleeping, that's all.
He took her hand. She let him lead her into the living room, where he settled her into the armchair. She smiled when he pulled a blanket over her and closed her eyes. He went back into the kitchen and swiftly, methodically swept the bottles and containers of blood into a garbage bag. He tied it at the top and brought it to his room, where he changed his bloody jacket for a new one and threw some things quickly into a duffel bag. He flipped the light off and left, closing the door behind him. His mother was already asleep as he passed through the living room. He reached out and lightly touched her hand. I'll be gone for a few days, he whispered.
But you won't worry. You won't expect me back. You think I'm on a school field trip. There's no need to call. Everything is fine.
He drew his hand back. In the dim light, his mother looked both older and younger than he was used to. She was as small as a child, curled under the blanket, but there were new lines on her face he didn't remember being there before. "Mom," he whispered. He touched her hand, and she stirred. Not wanting her to wake, he jerked his fingers back and moved soundlessly to the door, grabbing his keys from the table as he went.
The Institute was quiet. It was always quiet these days. Jace had taken to leaving his window open at night so he could hear the noises of traffic going by, the occasional wail of ambulance sirens, and the honking of horns on York Avenue. He could hear things mundanes couldn't, too, and their sounds filtered through the night and into his dreams. The rush of air displaced by a vampire's airborne motorcycle, the flutter of a winged fay, the distant howl of wolves at night when the moon was full. It was only half full now, casting just enough light for him to read by as he sprawled on the bed. He had his father's silver box open in front of him and was going through what was inside it. One of his father's steelies was in there, and a silver-handled hunting dagger with the initials SWH on the handle, and of most interest to Jace, a pile of letters. Over the past 6 weeks, he had taken to reading a letter or so every night, trying to get a sense for the man who was his biological father. A picture had begun to emerge, slowly, of a thoughtful young man with hard-driving parents who had been drawn to Valentine and the Circle because they had seemed to offer him an opportunity to distinguish himself in the world. He had kept writing to Amatis even after their divorce, something she hadn't mentioned before. In those letters, his disenchantment with Valentine and sickness at the Circle's activities were clear, though he rarely, if ever, mentioned Jace's mother, Celine. It made sense. Amatis wouldn't have wanted to hear about her replacement, and yet, Jace could not help hating his father a little for it. If he hadn't cared about Jace's mother, why marry her? If he'd hated the Circle so much, why hadn't he left it? Valentine had been a madman, but at least he'd stood by his principles. And then, of course, Jace only felt worse for preferring Valentine to his real father. What kind of person did that make him? A knock on the door drew him out of his self-recriminations. He got to his feet and went to answer it, expecting Isabel to be there, wanting to either borrow something or complain about something. But it wasn't Isabel. It was Clary. She wasn't dressed the way she usually was. She had a low-cut black tank top on, a white blouse tied loose and open over it, and a short skirt, short enough to show the curves of her legs up to mid-thigh. She wore her bright red hair in braids, loose curls of it clinging against the hollows of her temples, as if it had been raining lightly outside. She smiled when she saw him, arching her eyebrows. They were coppery, like the fine eyelashes that framed her green eyes. "Aren't you going to let me in?" He looked up and down the hallway. No one else was there, thank God. Taking Clary by the arm, he pulled her inside and shut the door. Leaning against it, he said, "What are you doing here? Is everything all right?" "Everything's fine." She kicked off her shoes and sat down on the edge of the bed. Her skirt rode up as she leaned back on her hands, showing more thigh. It wasn't doing wonders for Jace's concentration. "I missed you, and Mom and Luke are asleep. They won't notice I'm gone. You shouldn't be here." The words came out as a sort of groan. He hated saying them, but knew they needed to be said, for reasons she didn't even know, and he hoped she never would. "Well, if you want me to go, I will." She stood up. Her eyes were shimmeringly green. She took a step closer to him. "But I came all the way here. You could at least kiss me goodbye." He reached for her and drew her in and kissed her. There were some things you had to do, even if they were a bad idea. She folded into his arms like delicate silk. He put his hands in her hair and ran his fingers through it and twisting her braids until her hair fell around her shoulders the way he liked it. He remembered wanting to do this the first time he had seen her, and dismissing the idea as insane. She was a mundane. She'd been a stranger. There'd been no sense in wanting her. And then he had kissed her for the first time, in the greenhouse, and it had almost made him crazy. They had gone downstairs and been interrupted by Simon, and he had never wanted to kill anyone as much as he had wanted to kill Simon in that moment, though he knew, intellectually, that Simon hadn't done anything wrong. But what he felt had nothing to do with intellect, and when he had imagined her leaving him for Simon, the thought had made him sick and scared, the way no demon ever had. And then Valentine had told them they were brother and sister, and Jace had realized that there were worse things, infinitely worse things, than Clary leaving him for someone else. And that was knowing that the way he loved her was somehow cosmically wrong, that what had seemed the most pure and most irreproachable thing in his life had now been defiled beyond redemption. He remembered his father saying that when angels fell, they fell in anguish, because once they had seen the face of God, and now they never would again. And he had thought he knew how they felt. It had not made him want her any less. It had just turned wanting her into torture. Sometimes the shadow of that torture fell across his memories, even when he was kissing her, as he was now, and made him crush her more tightly to him. She made a surprise noise, but didn't protest, even when he lifted her up and carried her over to the bed. They sprawled onto it together, crumpling some of the letters, Jace knocking the box itself aside to make room for them. His heart was hammering against the inside of his ribs. They had never been in bed together like this before. Not really. There had been that night in her room in Idris, but they had barely touched. Jocelyn was careful never to let either of them spend the night where the other one lived. She didn't care much for him, Jace suspected, and he could hardly blame her. He doubted he would have liked himself much if he had been in her position. "I love you," Clary whispered. She had his shirt off, and her fingertips were tracing the scars on his back, and the star-shaped scar on his shoulder that was the twin of her own, a relic of the angel whose blood they both shared. "I don't ever want to lose you." He slid his hand down to untie her knotted blouse, his other hand braced against the mattress, touched the cold metal of the hunting dagger. It must have spilled onto the bed with the rest of the contents of the box. "That will never happen." She looked up at him with luminous eyes. "How can you be so sure?" His hand tightened on the knife hilt. The moonlight that poured through the window slid off the blade as he raised it. "I'm sure," he said, and brought the dagger down. The blade sheared through her flesh as if it were paper, and as her mouth opened in a startled O and blood soaked the front of her white shirt, he thought, "Dear God, not again." Waking up from the nightmare was like crashing through a plate glass window. The razored shards of it seemed to slice at Jace even as he pulled free and sat up, gasping. He rolled off the bed, instinctively wanting to get away, and hit the stone floor on his hands and knees. Cold air poured through the open window, making him shiver, but clearing away the last clinging tendrils of the dream. He stared down at his hands. They were clean of blood. The bed was a mess, the sheets and blankets screwed into a tangled ball from his tossing and turning, but the box containing his father's things was still on the nightstand, where he'd left it before he went to sleep. The first few times he'd had the nightmare, he'd woken up and vomited. Now he was careful about not eating for hours before he went to sleep, so instead his body had its revenge on him by racking him with spasms of sickness and fever. A spasm hit now, and he curled into a ball, gasping and dry heaving until it passed. When it was over, he pressed his forehead against the cold stone floor. Sweat was cooling on his body, his shirt sticking to him, and he wondered, not idly, if eventually the dreams would kill him. He had tried everything to stop them, sleeping pills and potions, runes of sleep and runes of peace and healing. Nothing worked. The dreams stole like poison into his mind, and there was nothing he could do to shut them out. Even during his waking hours, he found it hard to look at Clary. She had always been able to see through him the way no one else had, and he could only imagine what she would think if she knew what he dreamed. He rolled onto his side and stared at the box on the nightstand, moonlight sparking off it, and he thought of Valentine. Valentine, who had tortured and imprisoned the only woman he'd ever loved, who had taught his son, both his sons, that to love something is to destroy it forever. His mind spun frantically as he said the words to himself over and over. It had become a sort of chant for him, and like any chant, the words had started to lose their individual meanings. I'm not like Valentine. I don't want to be like him. I won't be like him. I won't. He saw Sebastian, Jonathan, really, his sort of brother, grinning at him through a tangle of silver-white hair, his black eyes shining with merciless glee. And he saw his own knife go into Jonathan and pull free, and Jonathan's body tumbling down toward the river below, his blood mixing with the weeds and grass at the riverbank's edge. I am not like Valentine. He had not been sorry to kill Jonathan. Given the chance, he would do it again. I don't want to be like him. Surely it wasn't normal to kill someone, to kill your own adoptive brother, and to feel nothing about it at all. I won't be like him. But his father had taught him that to kill without mercy was a virtue, and maybe you could never forget what your parents taught you, no matter how badly you wanted to. I won't be like him. Maybe people could never really change. I won't.
Chapter 4. The Art of Eight Limbs.
Here are enshrined the longing of great hearts and noble things, the tower above the tide, the magic word that winged wonder starts, the garnered wisdom that has never died.
The words were engraved over the front doors of the Brooklyn Public Library at Grand Army Plaza. Simon was sitting on the front steps, looking up at the facade. Inscriptions glittered against the stone in dull gilt, each word flashing into momentary life when caught by the headlights of passing cars. The library had always been one of his favorite places when he was a kid. There was a separate children's entrance around the side, and he had met Clary there every Saturday for years. They would pick up a stack of books and head for the Botanic Garden next door, where they could read for hours, sprawled in the grass. The sound of traffic, a constant dull thrumming in the distance. How he had ended up here tonight, he wasn't quite sure. He had gotten away from his house as fast as he could, only to realize he had nowhere to go. He couldn't face going to Clary's. She'd be horrified at what he'd done and would want him to go back to fix it. Eric and the other guys wouldn't understand. Jace didn't like him, and besides, he couldn't go into the Institute. It was a church. And the reason the Nephilim lived there in the first place was precisely to keep creatures like him out. Eventually, he had realized who it was he could call, but that thought had been unpleasant enough that it had taken him a while to screw up the nerve to actually do it. He heard the motorcycle before he saw it, the loud roar of the engine cutting through the sounds of light traffic on Grand Army Plaza. The cycle careened across the intersection and up into the pavement, then reared back and shot up the steps. Simon moved aside as it landed lightly beside him and Raphael released the handlebars. The motorcycle went instantly quiet. Vamp motorcycles were powered by demonic spirits and responded like pets to the wishes of their owners. Simon found them creepy.
You want to see me, Daylighter?
Raphael, as elegant as always in a black leather jacket and expensive-looking jeans, dismounted and leaned his motorcycle against the library railing.
This better be good, he added. It is not for nothing that I come all the way to Brooklyn. Raphael Santiago does not belong in an outer border.
Oh, good. You're starting to talk about yourself in the third person. That's not a sign of impending megalomania or anything. Raphael shrugged.
You can either tell me what you